Why is it that with sparkling water, I'm always playing guessing games with what flavor I'm drinking? Is it citrus? Is it aluminum can flavored? Not sure. Sparkling ice, though, they really mean flavor. Like, in-your-face flavor. Orange mango, black raspberry. Don't even get me started on the strawberry lemonade. Kiwi strawberry slid right into my taste buds' DMs last night and let them know who's boss. No subtleties there, and no sugar either. But it does have vitamins and antioxidants. Find sparkling ice at a major grocery store or club retailer near you. Sparkling ice. Anything but subtle.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hi, I'm Malak Fouad, and welcome to What I Did Next from A&T Media. We're currently on our season break, and we'll be back with new episodes in March. In the meantime, I wanted to share my conversation with Prince Habes Helmi, who told me about his unique life journey and the Egyptian royal family. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram, X, or on LinkedIn for updates. And you can also find longer video clips from my interviews on YouTube. Here's my conversation with Prince Habes Helmi.
If you were to have a dinner party and you were to invite 5 or 6 guests, who would be your ideal choices?
Well, my ideal dinner party is with my family. That really is the case. And I would love to, especially now that I'm at the moment alone in Cairo, I'd love to have my wife and children and grandchildren around it. With me. So that would be my ideal time, yes.
Would you have any relatives who are no longer with us?
No, of course. I mean, it sounds crazy, but, you know, obviously I would be fascinated to even meet and talk, if you can imagine that, with the great Muhammad Ali. You know, because he was an incredible visionary, and what happened afterwards was not necessarily what he wanted. So I would be fascinated to hear his take on it.
I think if you had him at a dinner, you wouldn't need anyone else, would you?
I don't need to eat anything. I'd be happy just listen to him.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And how would you think he'd look at the world we're in today? I mean,
I think it's so different. You know, I mean, he was very much part of the Ottoman Empire, and he's usually in Egypt. He's depicted as an enemy of the Ottomans, and he wasn't. He was a reformer, and I think it's very unfortunate that they didn't listen to him. They fought him. It's not the other way around.
You mean the Ottomans fought
him? The Ottomans fought.
That's
they
right.
saw him as a rival and as a dangerous person. You know, Muhammad Ali is generally misunderstood, to my point of view. I mean, I'm not a historian, but I obviously have strong views about it.
It's very interesting because the Ottoman Empire at the time was a very decentralized way of managing.
Yes.
And yet Muhammad Ali, when he came to Egypt, went the opposite way, didn't he? He began to realize that he needed to, in order to make the country efficient,
yes,
he had to be much more centralized in his approach.
Well, yes and no. I think the Muhammad Ali needed to put law and order in the country. There was complete chaos in Egypt after the Napoleonic invasion. The French disrupted Egypt. The French are always saying how wonderful they were. But it's not the full story, because they disrupted the whole system. And then when they were defeated and had to leave, there was chaos. You know, it was real chaos.
Let's move on, if you don't mind, to the next question, which was looking at a favorite book, a favorite piece of music.
A favorite book? I think I must choose the Quran Kareem. Which is our guide in life. I remember my last conversation with Prince Yusuf Kamal. Prince Yusuf Kamal is a great figure in the royal family. He was in exile by then. This was in 1956, something like that. And he was living in Austria, and he invited me to tea. And it's just the two of us having tea at the Lausanne Palace. And so he said, "What are you doing now?" So I said, "Oh, I'm studying in England." "Oh, yes, yes, yes," he said. So how is your English?" I said, "Well, I had a lot of trouble, actually, to start with English. But I said, I'm better off. I'm better now. So I'm getting better at English." I said, "Oh, good, good, good. All business is in English. And all contracts have to be written in English," he said. It's the most precise language. And so I said, yes, I know about that. And then he said, "What are the languages?" I said, "Well, French, you know, I went to French schools. And so my first studied language is French." Yes. Very, very good playwrights they have. I said, "But not very serious people." And he said, what about your Arabic?" So I said, it's deteriorating because I'm in England and I don't have a lot of opportunity. So I said, "Well, what should I do?" And he said, "The Quran Kareem, it's in 30 juz parts, and you read one part every day."
That's wonderful advice.
And he says, learn your religion, yeah. You learn the language, and he says it'll inspire you. He says, just do that. Of course, I'm afraid I don't do that. But
it's sound advice.
It's his advice. So it reminded me. I said, "You know, what do you do?" "Well, you read the Quran Kareem." And then he said, "What about your Turkish?" So I said, "I took O-level Turkish at school, and it's not too bad." No, "These are origins. You mustn't forget that." And said, "Okay, all right." And then he said, "How about your German?" And I said, "Well, my German is not non-existent. Yes. I'd like to learn German." He said, "What? You don't know German? They're the only serious people in Europe." he says, "They're hardworking, intelligent." He says, and you go, you don't even know their language? What about your Persian?" And I said, "Persian, yes, I also would like to know, but I don't know
Persian. There's only so many hours in the day."
"You don't know Persian?" He says, "Your parents haven't educated you."
Isn't that funny?
I promise you, he said that. Then he said, "You know, the greatest poets that have ever existed were all Persians." And he says, "Saadi, Firdousi, Hafez, you don't know any of it?" I said, "No, I'm afraid I don't." And he started, imagine, he was about 90 by then.
He was reciting it.
He was reciting Persian poetry.
That's fabulous.
And even the old ladies at the palace were all looking around to see what was going on. And he was Nartisan, you know. And it's very musical.
Yes,
you know? So it was very impressive.
That's quite a story.
And he went on and on reciting Persian poetry. And he says, "What a shame you don't know any of it."
Absolutely. It's so funny how that was considered so important.
They were incredibly well educated. You see, I mean, this is six languages which he considered to be basic.
The fundamentals.
Fundamental. You first of all, you learn these six languages.
So he found you wanting in the end.
He found me uneducated, ignorant, and I'm afraid I still am.
That's very funny. And so what about music? You're a classical music fan.
Yes, it's funny that as well, because my mother was very musical, and I spent a lot of time with my mother when I was little, you know, I suppose like most kids, and she always had classical music on. And I always found it rather annoying.
And as a child,
making faces and ridiculing her music, which she didn't take to very kindly. And she said, "You must." But funny thing is that it's had an effect on me, obviously subconsciously.
Yes, it does. Yeah.
And nowadays I'm very fond of classical music, and I think it was her. she was always listening to classical music, which at the time I found detestable. But
and
then
what would,
with time, I learned to love
it. What would be your pick? You said you liked Beethoven?
I mean, all the great composers are geniuses. I mean, we just have to recognize that. I mean, Mozart's a genius, and Beethoven's another genius, and Wagner's another genius. Classical music genius. Yeah,
I agree.
I'm loath to pick one, actually. Mm,
it's difficult.
Yeah,
I think also music reflects a mood, and sometimes you're in the mood for the dramatic, and sometimes you're in the mood for something a bit softer.
Yes, but you put yourself in it, because you know the way you and I go and listen to it is that we buy a ticket to go to the opera. And very often we have to buy the ticket months before,
That's
2 months before, 6 months before. So you don't know what mood you're
That's
going
right.
to be in.
Yeah.
But on the night, once you sit down and the lights go down, you go into another world. And I think this sort of escapism is part of the experience that we all enjoy. We leave our everyday world behind and we join this imaginary world,
Absolutely.
You know.
So let's look a little bit at your early life.
I was born in Heliopolis, in our house. My mother insisted on giving birth to both my sister and I at home. And I was blessed by having a very close family life. I saw both my parents almost every day, pretty well every day. And there was a definite sort of love in
close
bond,
family unit.
Very strong. So this is a blessing. I mean, you know, not I know that a lot of people don't have that.
Absolutely, yes.
And I was just born into that. You know, I thank God for it. I think what I had privileged in my life is people. You know, I was given these lovely parents and very nice sister I'm very close to until today. And then teachers and people were wonderful with me. I mean,
were you home tutored?
Yeah,
you were.
No, not entirely. No, I went to the Jesuit school, to les Jesuits. They were a very good school and very cosmopolitan in our time. Lots of friends were Christians, Muslims, Jews, everything.
Lebanese, Syrian, the melting pot of
Egypt.
I mean,
it's very unusual. I mean, by the time I went to England, I realized how unusual it was.
And then you left Egypt in 1957, is that correct?
No, 53.
53, sorry, to France, is that correct?
To France, yeah. My father had been head of the Regency Council.
Yes.
There were three regents. But then the other two, Mahana got into trouble and I believe was under arrest.
Yes.
Barakat left. He found it going difficult.
Yes.
And father stayed to the bitter end. But I mean, you know, he was then dropped and then Republic was declared. And then it was arranged that my sister and I would go with my uncle, Muhammad Ali Ibrahim, and his wife and their two children. We went to Paris, to live in Paris. I then didn't see my father my sister and I didn't see our father for 5 years, which was quite long.
That's a long
time. Because then, for a while, they were under house arrest.
And they remained in Egypt?
They remained in Egypt. My father had already been in exile once in his life, so he thought, now that I'm back, I don't want to go out again, because last time I spent so much time abroad, you know, and I might not survive that and might not come back at all. So in the end, there was a court case and so on. So they had a hard time and they eventually left as well.
And it must have been very difficult for you and your sister to be apart for 5 years from your father.
Yes.
Was your mother also away from you?
Mother managed to come out twice on holiday. So we saw mother twice on holiday during those 5 years.
Because that's a very young age for you.
A very young age. We were, again, blessed by our relatives who looked after us wonderfully. I mean, we were just second family. It was wonderful. They Thank really God looked after us very, very well. So we weren't missing anything,
yes.
except, of course, our real parents were also in difficult circumstances, so that this was a worry.
Were you aware at that age of what was happening?
Yes, yes.
You were conscious of it.
Even when you're 15 or something, you're fully aware of what's going on.
And were you anxious about it? Did you worry about it?
I think so, yeah.
So from there, you went on to the UK to study?
Yes, yes. My parents wanted that. And I thought they were crazy because they sent a letter through a friend who very few friends managed to go and visit them because they needed the permit and all sorts of things. And most people terrified to go to do that. And but a very good friend went to see them and took a letter from them. And the mother was and father was saying, go and university in England. Either Oxford or Cambridge.
No other options.
No option. Either Oxford or yes. Cambridge, yeah.
So you did all your secondary school.
My English was appalling. It was very bad. You know, to be bad at English in France is just about the pits, you know. It shows how bad it was.
Absolutely. And then having to make it to
it
the UK.
It was my worst language subject at school. But anyway, I have very good friends from that school in Paris. So I gained from that in the sense that I retained very good friends from my school in Egypt, and then in Paris, and then in England.
Whenever I think of you, I always think of you as an Anglophile. I never think of you as a Francophile.
Oh no, I am. Yeah.
So you consider yourself a bit of both.
I'm a chameleon.
You're a chameleon, depending on where you
in
are.
In France, I'm French, and I'm blessed with the fact that you know I have this gift. I can feel. Completely at home, almost anywhere, I think. But these countries are countries I know very well. So if I go in the street, I mean, the moment I come back to Egypt, I feel, I'm home, you know. But if I go to Paris, I'm where I haven't lived all that much, I mean, apart from the school, I feel completely comfortable, you know.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you, because having lived in so many different places, where do you consider home? Fundamentally,
I know the original home is Egypt.
Egypt,
no doubt about it. Yeah.
And today, would it be more Istanbul because your immediate family are there?
Yeah, when you see, I suppose I'm part of something which no longer exists because we were brought up to think there was no difference between the two.
Yes,
virtually, yeah.
Absolutely, that's right.
So
we forget that today, don't we?
I don't really feel there's much difference. Although I mean, the two countries were. Odds until yesterday.
That's right.
But yesterday they've become friends
again. They've become friends again.
So such are politics in the Middle East, very complicated. But you know, I'm a dinosaur.
So in a way, you look at it in a borderless way, a bit like the Ottoman Empire itself was.
Yeah, I think it should be borderless. I don't see why we have all these. Complications between us, but that's how it is.
And your identity, if you were to say to somebody, you know, if someone was to ask you about your identity, what would that be for you?
I'm a Turco-Egyptian, you know. I mean, there's a lot of us. If you look at it, I think people don't. If you look at it the way Egypt is, you know, there's enormous link. Forget the Republic of Turkey. The Republic of Turkey is new. It's a new country. 1923, you know, I mean, it's yesterday. But the link, the cultural link with Turks, you know, is goes back, you know. Ahmed ibn Tulun in 950 or something broke away. He was the wali, the governor of Egypt. And he broke away from the Abbasiyin and governed Egypt. So when he struck his coins, which are at the Islamic Museum, he says, Duriba, minted, if you need it in English.
Yes.
Fil Imara, in the principality, et Turkiya, et Tuluniya. So Tulun is his name.
Tulun is his name, yes.
So the only name of the country is Turkey.
But he's meshed it all together.
So he said, Duriba fil Imara Turkiya Tuluniya. So he calls Egypt Turkey.
Yes.
Because he is Turkish. He is a Kapchak Turk, who's really basically the people from, who's now in Kazakhstan, and the tribes which are in Kazakhstan. Imagine he brought in Ahmed ibn Tulun. He himself brought in immediately. He started straight away because he needed to start a new series here. So he brings in 10,000 Kapchak boys, okay, the first year.
Yes.
Next year, he brings another 10,000. This is 950. Muhammad Ali is 1,800. And in 1,800, Muhammad Ali puts an end to the Mamluks.
Mm-hmm.
So look at it. From 900 to 1,800, 900 years.
Of intermarrying in Egypt.
They bring
yes.
roughly 10,000 Turks every year.
And so as you say, you can't separate them.
I think that most people you see walking in the street in Absolutely. Cairo have Turkish blood.
Absolutely. It's just by a simple calculation.
But then they married locally and stayed locally.
Yes.
So that's maybe some of the difference.
Yes.
We'll continue our conversation with Prince Habes Helmi right after this short break.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
I wanted to take a minute to tell you about our bonus episodes, available exclusively for subscribers. On each bonus episode, I take a deeper dive into my guests' industries, and I share some extra parts from our conversation. For example, actor and comedian Rami Youssef told me about his thoughts on cancel culture, and ex-anchor and now author Hela Gorani told me her thoughts on the future of journalism. All of these great stories are only available on our bonus episodes, so subscribe now to unlock this amazing extra content. You can subscribe in Apple Podcasts by clicking the subscribe button or on our website and get instant access to all our bonus episodes with a 2-week free trial. And now, back to the show. Welcome back. I'm Malak Fouad, and you're listening to What I Did Next from ANT Media. And our conversation today is with Prince Habes Helmi. In the 1960s, the prince went to Oxford, where he studied politics, philosophy, and economics, or PPE, and found himself interested in economics in particular. He then began working in finance in the City of London.
But eventually, Muhammad Yunus, who I had met when I was little, we knew each other from school. He's slightly older than me. And Muhammad created his own firm called Concord, where you are now. And I was the first person to join him. And so we had a hard time, to tell the truth, to start with. But then we eventually got the mandate to run the mutual funds of Bank Misr in Egypt. We were always trying to manage their dollars in the United States. But then they said, well, what about here? You know, so we took it. And then we hired a man to be the manager and to manage the funds and so on. And then that man let us down very badly 2 weeks before launch. And he said, no, I'm afraid I can't come and so on. What he didn't tell us is that he hadn't really told his employer that he was leaving.
I see.
So Muhammad said, well, you know, there's nothing we can do. The thing is going to go, and we've signed the contract to run it. And so you must do it. you stay and you run it until we can find somebody else. And of course, I'm still here.
And you're still here. Was the move to Egypt purely for the new position, or was there something else at play? Was there a desire to come back?
Yes. No, I agree. I think there was both. I had a great desire to come back. I've always wanted to come back. And I couldn't find a way to come back properly. So I suppose it fitted in with that.
With that plan or that desire?
This was probably the biggest challenge professionally that I've ever had, because, you know, had somebody in London been kind enough to offer me the job, similar to what Mohammed had offered me, they would have said, oh, hello, Hilmi, how are you? Here's your office, and here is your assistant, and here is your equipment, and get on
with
it.
Off you go.
You see? Except that here, we didn't have an office. We didn't have an assistant.
You built it all from scratch.
Yeah, we absolutely. And all these things which I assumed, you know, I never thought about, how do you choose a telephone, you know?
Yeah.
Telephone system.
Absolutely.
It's an office, you know, with lots of people.
Of course. And you're not thinking for the short term. You're thinking for,
yes,
you know.
Yes, yes. I mean, I buy this. It's quite expensive. Yeah. So once you bought it, you're stuck with it.
Yeah.
So I had to do all that. And it's very gratifying, really, because in the end, I thought, you know, we built it from scratch.
Yes.
From nothing.
Yeah.
And Mohammed was mostly in New York, coming and going. He's a wonderful sort of ideas man, and he sees very clearly everything. But I had to deal with the everyday problems. And, you know, I it wasn't easy, but in the end, it was a wonderful feeling of having built something.
How was it on a personal level being back and reintegrating within the family structure of who was left here, or the friends and the childhood friends?
No, that's a very nice part. And in fact, I had braced myself that I thought, after all the years and years of propaganda against us, you know, saying what monsters we were, I said, you know, one or two people are going to say things which are going to be unpleasant. And I must say, until today, nobody has ever said anything unpleasant, which I think says a lot for Egyptians, because I'm sure some of them maybe didn't approve of us, but they weren't unpleasant about it. And Egyptians are very friendly people, very, very nice people.
And while you were in the UK and in France as a younger man, and you'd heard all of this sort of propaganda that you just mentioned that was coming out of the Middle East and out of Egypt, how was that for you? How did that feel for you? Did you feel threatened?
When I was in abroad, it's frustrating because there's nothing you can do about it. Once you're here, then of course your presence, it means, you know, I don't think I look like a monster, and I'm not a monster. I think once you're here, it's no longer quite so frustrating.
Is there a balancing act that you have to adhere to when you're in Egypt now, or when you came back, that you felt that there were certain parameters you had to live within?
Well, I think that most of us who are westernized orientals are doing this balancing act, and I'm sure you're very familiar with it. And I think it's very tricky. And I always think that people who marry foreigners, you know, it's very difficult for the foreigner, because the foreigner doesn't quite get the balance right, you know. And it's easier, I always thought. You see, I saw several ladies, mostly, who married Saudis and in Saudi Arabia, and they fit in completely, because they adopt a completely different way of life, and that's it. You know, if they accept it,
yeah, they took it on board.
That's it.
Yeah.
But here, and in all our part of the world, it's much more complicated. It looks as if we're very westernized, but actually we have some hang-ups about this.
So we have more gray zones.
And you're never quite sure, if you're a foreigner, where the line is drawn.
Yes.
You know, it's tricky, but it comes naturally to us.
Of course. You're able to sort of put on a different coat, if you like.
Yes, yes.
And then take it off if you need to.
That's what I meant. You know, we're a bit, yeah, we're a bit chameleon-like. Yes, you know, yes. Which we keep changing.
And what about being a part of the royal family in Egypt? How is that for you? Did you find that you had to adhere to certain parameters in that way regarding any kind of public life that you might have
I have no public life. So that makes it easy.
Was that a conscious choice or?
Yeah. I've never been keen on that.
You never were?
No. Nor by being keen on politics.
So you now divide your time between Egypt and Turkey. Is that correct?
Correct.
So Istanbul is more now of the base.
Yes.
And in Turkey, there were stories a few years ago that Erdogan is quite interested in the Ottoman heritage and the Ottoman history and is putting a lot of energy behind that. How is that? Have you experienced that when
that
you're there?
That goes on, and I can't really make it out. I mean, I don't pretend to really understand what's going on because, I mean, some of it I'm very pleased about because, of course, it's our heritage. But and it was put down and not allowed in Turkey, which was wrong. I mean,
it was for a very long time. Yes.
I mean, you, especially when you have such a rich heritage.
Yes.
To not use it
and to deny it
and to deny it or not use it really.
Yes.
So pretend it didn't happen. Silly. I mean, it's just stupid. Mm. And an awful shame. But now it's gone back with a vengeance. And he has taken over the Hagia Sophia mosque, Hagia Sophia, and make
church,
it back into
yes.
into a mosque, which I don't approve of. They have restored a lot of mosques, which I'm very happy about, and they look wonderful. A lot of them, for example, he changed the constitution, and he's a executive president, whereas the president before that was just a figurehead. He's like a president, more or less, of France, something like that, you know, not far from it.
Right.
He has a lot of power and influence. And so this is a new function. So they were going to have the swearing in ceremony, you know. So before that, it wasn't important. So they went and asked him and said, well, what swearing in ceremony do we do? So he said, oh, do like the last sultan. The last sultan is Vahdettin. Vahdettin is my mother's grandfather.
Yes.
You know. So I watched it on television. I couldn't believe it. They said all, you know, they do zikr and prayers and so on, you know. It's very Islamic.
Yes.
But all the prayers was for Vahdettin, actually Vahdettin.
Really?
And they didn't mention him at all.
They didn't change the wording?
They didn't.
How strange.
I can't make it out.
That's very strange.
Does he not want it? Maybe he doesn't want his name mentioned like that.
Yes.
But to actually say the prayers for Vahdettin, which of course is my great grandfather,
so you were very happy to hear it.
Very, very surprised and pleasantly surprised to hear it, but I can't understand it.
Yeah.
And then another relative came and I said, I'm sure you want to go to Friday prayers. And he said, yes. So his hotel, the Swiss hotel, behind it is the Hamidiyya Mosque, Sultan Abdul Hamid had built. And again, it had fallen into disrepair and they restored it very well. And on Friday, Friday prayers, etc. So I took this relative, who's my Jordanian relative, is also related to the Ottoman family. So I took him there, and then we said on Friday prayers. And then the dua came, and in the dua, they went on and on about Sultan Abdul Hamid, and not a word about the present people.
Very nothing. Strange.
Nothing.
So it's they're glorifying that era.
Yes.
Very interesting.
And I But they don't make the link.
They don't make the connection.
Well, most Turks don't understand what they're talking about anyway. They don't know Arabic.
Absolutely.
And it's all in Arabic.
Of course.
So tell me a little bit about the work you're doing now in terms of restoration in Egypt and the association.
Well, I don't do anything, but I'm trying to be involved in heritage preservation. I think that's what. So I've picked on Manuel because it was done by my great uncle Prince Muhammad Ali Tawfiq. And I thought it's a duty for me, really, I think, to try and save something from what he did. You know, all his life he was a great collector, and he had a wonderful collection, and he made all these buildings, and he saved the gardens, which again are in danger now of extinction, really, because they're not looking after it properly. And these gardens are very old. Some of the trees are 400 or 500 years old. So it's Mamluk. It's a Mamluk garden.
It's quite impressive as a
very
space.
Very old yes. garden. And he added to it. He brought in plants and so on. He was very keen on that and very knowledgeable about it, and he wrote about it. And he brought in plants from the Far East, and he brought in plants from Mexico, and he loved the traveling. So we're trying to save that.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's been an ongoing project for quite a number of years now, hasn't it?
Yes, yes. And again, I'm blessed with having wonderful friends and so on who are very keen as well. And we're all together. So it's made a nice group, and it's a nice feeling of togetherness.
Of course.
You know, yeah.
And do you find that for yourself on a sort of a personal level, that it's a way for you to give back a little bit to Egypt
by
preserving your own personal heritage as well?
Egypt is so rich, you know. I mean, it goes back thousands of years, as you know. So it's a bit daunting to preserve heritage in Egypt, I must say. You know, I mean, where do you start? You know, there's so much. So I think where do you start is with the thing that's obvious to you, the thing that's in front of you. And Manuel is in front of us. You know, it's on the island of Rhoda. It's in the middle of Cairo. So, and when we started off, there was a hotel there, as you probably remember.
The Club Med, right?
It's Club Med, yes. With shacks. It wasn't me. I mean, I had nothing to do with it. I think Farouk Ghoda is a Egyptian poet, as you probably know, and he writes in Dahram and so on. And he mounted a campaign to save Manuel.
When was this?
I admire this.
Was this in the early 90s? What sort of period?
Yeah,
it
was the 90s.
Early 90s.
Mid 90s.
And I believe you also renovated and restored some family mausoleums as well, didn't you?
Yes, yes. This is where Prince Muhammad Ali, for example, is buried. It's the mausoleum of Khadiwa Tawfi, and they call it Ubba Tafandina. But this is the popular name for it. And I think it's a very fine building because it's an Art Nouveau Mamluk style.
Interesting.
Which
is
a very
combination.
Much in fashion in 1900. Antonio Lasiak, which was the court architect, he built a lovely thing.
And are there any other projects you're working on at the moment? Conservation projects?
Not really, no.
No,
I think that these two give me enough time, a lot of.
And they're ongoing, are they? They're continuing.
Well, our main thing now is that we are trying to reopen the museum, the actual museum at Manuel. Manuel, what you see now in the buildings, but the museum itself is closed, and all the artifacts are kept in storage. So we're friends of a museum which is closed.
And when what is the status on that? When is it likely to open? Or
well, we as an association are starting. are hoping to kickstart it. So we'll do a little bit and hope that it will encourage others to come and help us finish it.
Well, thank you very, very much for your time. That was very, very interesting.
Pleasure.
I'm delighted that you were with us.
Thank you.